Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Johnny Tan, author of From My Mama's Kitchen, Food for the Soul, Recipes for a Living. Welcome to my weekly From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio show. My guest for this morning is Claire Price. Claire is a former business journalist, technology reporter, internet industry analyst, and a VP of marketing for several software startups. Claire and I will be discussing her latest book, Web of Betrayal. Good morning, Claire. Welcome to From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. How are you doing this morning?
Good morning, Johnny. It's wonderful to be here. Thank you so much for inviting me.
You have a very interesting background, and Web of Betrayal is a wonderful read, so congratulations.
Thank you.
Let us start by getting to know you a little better. Please give us a quick walkthrough of your life from childhood to the present moment.
Okay. It's been a wild ride, so hopefully I can do this quickly. I have always loved to write. I wrote my first story when I was 5 years old, called My Dog Nikki. Wrote a play, got all my friends and family corralled into doing plays and things like that. So I really wanted to make writing my career. It didn't turn out quite that way, but I did start by going to Berkeley and majoring in both rhetoric and also did a lot of work in the journalism department, and then went to Stanford for an intensive journalism course, a summer course. And then my first writing job was with the LA Business Journal as a stringer. Stringer is someone who is kind of on call for jobs and different stories and things like that. And that's actually what got me interested in technology, because they kept sending me to cover all these new emerging technology shows. And, I mean, these things were tiny. They were in little tiny halls with literally cardboard tables with people with trying off to show their computer gear and computer things like that. So I really got interested in technology, and that led me to accepting a position as a technology journalist with CMP Publications and the CIN computer paper that Peter works for early in the book is kind of a little bit based on my experience there. And from there, I also was privileged to work with the Gartner Group at the beginning of the Internet and with a lot of some of the big companies that have now, you know, become the foundation of the Internet, like Cisco, Microsoft, IBM, Sun Microsystems. I was actually a marketing manager there. So my background is unique because it's both writing and journalism and also computer marketing and analysis, primarily in the software space and in the Internet networking space. So I think that's kind of a quick roundup.
Wonderful. When did you discover you have a talent for writing? I know you started at a very young age, but when did it kind of really have that sort of creativity that kicks into the overdrive?
I have to tell you, I think it started when I was first started reading, because I started, it's really kind of funny, because I learned to read and I got to read all the, you know, childhood stories my parents, the parents always give you and tell you. And I started thinking, hey, I can make up some characters too. So I started making up my own characters. And that started very, very early. But in terms of really wanting to make it a career, I would have to say that started in high school. I was associate editor of my high school newspaper. And that's at the point where I really said, I want to do this. And that's when I started sort of moving my career in that direction.
Interesting. Who are some of your favorite authors?
Well, I would say that my favorite authors in my genre, which is the mystery thriller genre, my top favorite probably is Scott Turow. And the reason that I love his books so much is because they are unique in the genre in that they're very non-formula. He has very deep character studies. He has a lot of moral dilemmas. And he really dives deep into a new set of characters pretty much with every book. And that's something I also want to do with my books. Is although I am writing a sequel to Web of Betrayal now, it'll probably be out late 2015, early 2016, I don't want to really be a serial author that, you know, writes the mm-hmm. same character every time. I love that about him. I also read a lot of Grisham, John Grisham, Michael Connelly in my mm-hmm. genre. I think they're all good writers. Outside of that, for historical novels, my favorite is Gone with the Wind. Mm-hmm. And I think, again, that was something that I did borrow with my book. I set it in 1994 because 1994 for the computer industry was a pivotal year, just as the Civil War was a pivotal time for our country. Obviously, you can't compare the Civil War to, you know, what's happening in technology. Don't want to do that. But there are pivot points in history, and 1994 for the internet was one of those pivot points, and that's why it shows that. For general, one other kind of adventure reading and fantasy reading that I love to do, and also for great deep characters and moral dilemmas, is The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit with J.R.R. Tolkien.
Very interesting. Writing as a career in the internet industry or business industry as a whole, how does that differ from writing a novel?
It's really different in some ways. I think with business, you really have a goal is to teach and educate.
Yeah.
And you want to make sure that your audience walks away knowing something that they didn't know before, or knowing something better that they did know that they got a deeper knowledge of. Mm-hmm. You also want to help them improve their business. I've written 5 marketing books. They're
yeah.
actually not available yet as books. I use them as consulting. I provide them only to my own consultants or my own mm-hmm. Consulting clients, but I will be publishing those within the next year or so as well. Being a novelist, you really have to tell a story. That's mm-hmm. that to me is the main point. If you don't have a good story, people aren't going to read your book. You mm-hmm. can have great description, you can have, you know, interesting characters, but if the characters aren't going anywhere,
yeah.
I don't think you're going to capture the audience's imagination. And that's the other thing. What you want to do with a novel is you want to capture the imagination. You want to really take people out of the space that they're in and take them somewhere completely different. And my goal writing my novel was to put people and take people to a place that many of them have never been. Or mm-hmm. for those mm-hmm. of us who were in the industry at that time, maybe get to re-experience and reignite the excitement that was really happening at that very pivotal point in the industry. So that's why I decided. I also saw that, you know, I love the computer industry. I have to say, I love the technology.
Mm-hmm.
When I first was a reporter learning about it, and I kind of infused this a little bit into Peter Ellis's character, my main character, is that real mm-hmm. interest in technology and what was going to happen, what was going to change the world. Because we were really right at that point when these companies were just beginning to say, oh, this is really going to make a difference. This is going to change the way people live and work every single day. Didn't mm-hmm. really know how it was going to happen, but we knew it was going to happen. And that excitement, I just have always felt that with the industry. I'm still in the industry. I do have a regular job. I'm vice president of a company called research for a company called Demand Metric, and we do mm-hmm. consulting for technology companies. So I still have my foot in that world and continue to write about it both from a business and from a novel fiction perspective.
Very interesting. It reminds me about the TV series Castle. Of course, that's an author that shadows the New York Police Department, but it's
yes,
almost
yes,
like
Jerry
that.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Yeah, exactly. And I think that will keep my writing fresh. I do
mm-hmm.
intend to continue to write unless I'm drawn in a completely different area. I do continue to want to set my books in the technology environment because it's different. There are so many
yeah.
legal thrillers. There's medical thrillers. There's all
yeah.
there's spy stuff. There's political stuff. I only actually know one other author. I'm sure there's
mm-hmm.
more, and mm-hmm. that I'm not aware of. But the only other author I know who really sets his books in the Silicon Valley is Keith Raffel,
mm-hmm.
Who wrote the book Drop Dead or Dot Dead, excuse me, DOT Dead, and mm-hmm. Smasher. So. And I actually read his books as I was writing mine and saw how he could really use that the Valley as a place for fiction. When
yeah.
most of the books that come out of the Valley are business books and technical books for, I think, an obvious reason.
Do you catch yourself daydreaming a whole lot?
I do when I'm in the character formation stage and when I'm in the plotting stage. I definitely will, scenes will pop into my head, and I will sort of live those scenes for a while and kind of see what the characters are doing. I really try to give my characters a lot of free rein and let them kind of go where they want to go. So I think daydreaming and imagining things is a really good way to do that with characters.
Do you use your storytelling as a personal escape at times just to entertain yourself or to entertain others?
I would have to say both. I would have to say that I love escaping into my own world. I think all writers
yeah.
do. Spend a lot of time in the world of your characters. When I was writing Web of Betrayal and doing some of the editing work for it before publication in the last, say, 18 months to 2 years, I did a lot of my work on the weekend. So I would start late Friday and go through the entire weekend, and I was in a different world. I was actually in a different time to 1994. So I actually felt like I was, I'd get the bends when I'd come out of that world on Monday morning and sort of have to go back to, oh, it's 2014 again. What do you know? so that was part of my escape. But I think the real goal of a writer is to entertain the reader and make sure that the reader has a really, really good experience with their book. And one of the things that I did do in this book that I think is unique for fiction is I wanted to make it an immersive read. So I wanted to immerse the reader in the book in the time as fully as possible. So one of the things that we incorporated into the book, in the digital edition, the Kindle edition, it's links. And in the paperback edition, it's actually QR codes to music, to times, to places in the 90s. So if you wanted to, say, experience some music or see some pictures or see some of the things that the characters are most interested in, that is incorporated in the book as well so that you can really sort of step into that time period.
It is definitely a very interesting approach. So what is the inspiration behind Web of Betrayal?
Well, I really just, the story came to me. I don't know any other way to say it. I started thinking about watching what was going on in the industry at the time. I actually wrote the first draft of the story in 1994, got a publisher, and the publisher went out of business before the book was published. So. But to go back to your question, the inspiration was really looking at the industry and looking at the characters that I was meeting. I was lucky enough as a reporter to meet some of the giants of our industry early in their careers, like Bill Gates and Steve Jobs and people like that. So I think I did, you know, that was a lot of the inspiration, is seeing, you know, how those people were figuring out some of the things that they were learning at the time. I didn't want to write another biopic book. I didn't want to write another, you know, computer visionary biopic type of thing. I wanted people to just experience the excitement and really feel like, hey, I can be that person. I can be in this environment and I can be making some of those decisions. So I tried to make the characters people you love or love to hate, as opposed to so that you would be inspired by what was happening.
Wonderful. Please give us a synopsis of the novel.
Okay. The year, as I said, is 1994, and companies from London to Silicon Valley are fighting to claim the billions to be made on a new information highway. Peter Ellis, our main character, is an aggressive investigative reporter fighting to reclaim his damaged reputation after being framed for rigging a story. And he's at the computer show in Las Vegas. He learns that a programmer who's skilled in cryptography, which is cracking encrypted computer code, has mysteriously disappeared. Peter's quest to find the missing programmer pits him against a brilliant hacker and vengeful assassin with an agenda of his own. He's taking revenge against the man who ruined his life, computer industry luminary David Lockwood, who is posed to introduce a product that will change the internet forever. As Peter is drawn into the vengeful assassination's deadly game of betrayal and murder, he is faced with losing everything he holds dear. His career, his one true love, and even his own life. And the story is, can Peter get the bad guy? Can he survive? One of the things that happens in the book is, you know, there's a lot of risk taking. There's a lot of not just a physical trauma, but emotional and psychological trauma as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The main thrust of the story is the assassin has put all of the critical information about his livelihood and his life onto a disc, which he sends to one of his trusted friends and mentor, and that person sends that disc to people that he thinks are going to potentially crack it. So we're trying to find a very important disc, floppy disc of the time, throughout the book. So cracking that code, cyber security and cyber attack is part of the book as well.
It's something nostalgic about it, floppy disk versus flash drive.
I know. Yeah. In fact, the first editor that I had who reviewed the book changed. I had the floppy disk in the beginning, and she changed it to flash drive because she's a younger person. And I said, wait a minute,
right.
It's 1994. No flash drive here.
That's very interesting. How much research did you do for the book?
I do a lot of research. Of course, as I said, I read the first draft in 1994. I was in the industry, so it was around me and easy to access at that time. After the book, the publisher went out of business and I wasn't able to publish the book, I put it aside and I didn't come back to it until 2011. So it then became much more of a retrospective for me to write the book, and I did have to go back and do research to make sure that I wasn't putting in dialogue, technology, fashions, anything that would bring people out of that specific time and place. So it required a lot of detailed, careful checking to make sure that things were not being used that were not actually available in 1994.
That's true, though. You don't want to get caught with something that it's today's technology that you were trying to explain in 1994 because it really didn't exist at that time.
Yeah, I'll give you a real quick example from the book. In the very beginning of the book, Peter's at the trade show, and David Lockwood is doing the keynote presentation, and he has a laptop, and he has a laptop on in his hand, and he's doing a video presentation from his laptop. And what I had to do was make sure that I indicated that there was a wire. There was, you know, that it was not wireless because at that time we didn't have that kind of wireless technology. So those are kind of some of the details that I really tried to check. I'm sure there's some we missed, and I'm sure some eagle eyes out there will probably find them, but hopefully not many.
So true. Can you please walk us through the significance of 1994 in the internet world?
Johnny, I really consider 1994 to be the watershed year for the commercial internet. And I recently did a blog post for the Broadside about this. There were 20 significant events that really made a 1994 really the watershed year. I'll just mention a few of them. One, Yahoo was introduced in 1994. That was a precursor to the Google search engine. Amazon was incorporated in 1994. The first commercial browser was actually introduced in this month in 1994.
Mm-hmm.
The first big internet radio or internet streaming video concert took place with the Rolling Stones in 1994. So it really was a point at which the technology that was in the lab first really became accessible and available to to people out in the world. Another thing that we all look at today, the first web banner ad was actually produced in 1994. So when you go to your computer and see all those banner ads popping up in front of your face, you can thank the guy in 1994 who did the first one.
That's so interesting. I think we take a lot of things for granted because it's just there. But it's wonderful to have an opportunity to really find out when did it all get started. Those, to me, are just wonderful information to be aware of.
That's so true. And I tried to really imbibe that into the book because there's one scene where Peter and his girlfriend and they're out to dinner with another couple and they start talking about the internet. One of the guys is a banker and he's like, you know, this internet stuff, this is like crazy. And Peter's saying, well, someday we're going to be able to do our banking on the internet. And the guy is laughing and, just like, that's totally ridiculous. Well, of course, now we take that for granted.
Right.
And the other thing that happens in that scene, which is kind of interesting, is that his wife brings up the fact that, oh, we got this disk in the mail from AOL. We want to try this new email thing. You know, and one reviewer actually recalled when they got their first disk from AOL in the mail, because those disks were floating around for many years to get people to try email.
Right. Well, what's interesting is a few years leading to 1994, you're looking at years of possibilities of the unknown, because it really challenges the mind. The creative juices are really kicking in. You're literally going out and creating things out there, ways of taking advantage of the new knowledge that we all have. Now, there are a bunch of us that are just going to work 9 to 5 every day, and then there are a bunch of people that say, well, this is not going to work. And then there are a bunch of people that are very excited and daring to just push the limits.
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah, so that's very, very exciting. How did you go about in choosing the various characters?
I love to write characters. In terms of my own writing as a writer, I love to write characters. I spend a lot of time creating detailed character analysis of my characters, just the main couple of characters, 2 or 3 that are the top ones in the book.
Yeah.
And I wanted to choose characters that were real, but also represented people that I knew in the industry. But everybody but Toby Eastman, who I never knew, a hacker assassin, although I'm sure there's one or two out there, but I never knew him personally. I have to be honest about that. He's completely imaginative character. Mm-hmm. But people like Peter, David Lockwood, Margaret Ellis, who are in the book, are all composites of people that I actually either worked with or knew or was associated with in that time and space.
Interesting. From a real life timeline as well, because the internet also give rise what I consider as equal opportunity scenario. Because if you have the creativity, it doesn't matter what gender you are or race or whatever that may be, because now you have this completely gigantic whiteboard that you can start creating things.
That is so true. Absolutely.
I think that's something that sometimes we tend to forget, because for the first time, being a brainiac is cool.
Exactly, yeah. Age of the geek.
Well, what it does also, I think from an economic standpoint of view, for the first time, you are seeing the new economy in terms of the creative class. It's no longer the upper class, but the creative class, where the field is pretty much as level.
I totally agree. I think that's a wonderful breakthrough and move forward that the internet and technology has given to us, is the ability for everyone who has a bright idea can see that dream come true, can actually experiment with their idea, whereas before it took so much money, so much time, so much energy to even begin to produce an idea. And I'm not saying that companies don't need funding, because of course we know they do.
Right.
But you can get your ideas started very quickly these days, and I think that that's a testament to what the technology has been able to offer to us.
Mm-hmm. What was the most challenging aspects in composing the novel?
I would say it was when I went back to it and started writing it for the present day, for release in 2014, mm-hmm. is staying true to the time and also making sure that people really felt the excitement. It's really easy for technology to be dry, and mm-hmm. I think that's why a lot of people have not attempted to write with this environment. But I really wanted to make sure that the characters were strong enough and the action was forceful enough, gripping enough, that it would really draw people in. So I would say that was the most challenging aspect, was making sure that the characters were really, you know, interesting enough and the technology did not overwhelm the book. That was my other really struggle, because I'm very steeped in technology. I've lived most of my career in it, but other readers are not, and I didn't want the technology to be a barrier to their enjoyment of the book. I wanted it to be something that they would like maybe go, "Oh, I didn't know about that," or you know, something a little interesting for them.
Very interesting. Why did you choose to write a fictionalized account of what happened?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, and just want to reemphasize, there's a lot of business and biopics that come out of the Valley, and I think that's mostly what we've seen. I'd say that's probably 99% of what the books are written about the Valley. And I felt like there's a better story to tell. There was a real human story to tell. These are real people. They have their own challenges. They have their fears. They have their insecurities. They have the need to accomplish. They have threats. They are, sometimes in a very scary place. And that part of that story isn't told. And I think the only way you can tell it is through a fictional account that really gets the reader into the heads of the people that are actively, facing these challenges and facing these threats and betrayal. There's a lot of dirty deeds that go on in that part of the world. So, some of this is definitely showcased in the novel.
How much of you is in the novel?
Well, I think as a writer, we always bring ourselves into what we write. And for me, the character of Peter Ellis is in some ways an alter ego. Mm-hmm. A lot of the experiences I had as a reporter, I did imbibe into his character. The way he works as a reporter is a lot of the ways that I worked. So definitely that's in the novel. The other thing that's in the novel is one of my kind of fun passions. I compete in dog agility, which is obstacle courses for dogs, and it's a very competitive sport. And so there's a scene in the novel where Peter goes to interview a source, and that source is actually competing in dog agility. So I got to showcase one of my passions in the book as well.
That's wonderful. The book talks a lot about ruthlessness, about people, situations, and so forth. Are those really real?
I do think they represent the reality of the business environment, and not just in the Valley, but at any time that there's major corporations that are fighting for billions of dollars, it's going to be a very ruthless game that they play. I'm not going to say that major corporations are out there murdering people, but in terms of the backstabbing, the double dealing, the betrayal, the stealing of people's ideas, the one-upmanship that goes on, absolutely. I have observed it. It's absolutely real. And as I said, it's not just a part of the Valley. It's, I think, unfortunately, part of a lot of business environments.
Sure. And some people are driven by greed. Some people
exactly.
are driven by just the
exactly.
idea, the concept of being number one. And then mm-hmm. you have the engineers, the creators, who are just driven by possibilities.
Exactly. And I tried to showcase each of those characters in the book. David Lockwood is not driven by money. He's driven by, he wants to open up a new world. I mean, obviously he has a massive ego. Most of the major computer visionaries that you run into do often have those large egos, but I think that that's part of what makes it possible for them to break through barriers that other people are not able to break through.
Right.
There's absolutely the ruthlessness of some of the heads of the major companies there. So I try to illustrate all of the points that you just mentioned, Johnny, in some of my characters.
Are some of the landmarks and institutions mentioned in the novel still in existence?
Yes. I actually very much tried to anchor the book with real places that were popular at the time. The Alpine Inn is still a very popular restaurant. In fact, it has a real history with the internet itself. So that was a great choice for one of the scenes. The other clubs and things that are in the book, for the most part, are real and are places that people could go to visit today. Some are not. If I couldn't find one that was real, that's where the fiction comes in.
Yeah, I understand.
Like the dance club that Peter goes to with his girlfriend is actually not one that was there. I tried to find one and I couldn't find exactly what I needed, so kind of made that one up.
Interesting. What would you like for the readers to gain from reading Web of Betrayal?
I want them to be entertained, most of all. I want them to have a great time. I want them to be able to just enjoy the story, get into it, and sort of step outside whatever it is that they're doing and really have that kind of new world open up to them. And I also hope that they really kind of enjoy the people, and they find people that they want to love and they want to love to hate, and that they that person might stick in their mind a little bit, and they might maybe learn something from that person or the way that they handle, you know, their crises and challenges.
Mm-hmm. Where can someone go to buy the book, get more information about you, and keep up with your latest happenings?
Well, I would first encourage everyone to go to my website, which is webofbetrayal.com, and take a look at my trailer. I love my trailer. It's only 45 seconds, but it's a fast-moving kind of peek at the book. And I also, the website, I really created it, Johnny, to be not your typical author website. I wanted it to be, again, part of my strategy is to make this book as immersive as possible. So the website really is an invitation to step into the book. It has the characters. It has some bios about them. It has information about the different places, as well as the trailer, synopsis, and the ability to read the first chapter of the book if you want to just sample it before you might purchase. The book is currently right now available on Amazon, so you can purchase it there.
That's wonderful. It has been 21 years since the internet was first turned on, since 1994, that is. What is your current impression of the World Wide Web?
Well, I think as we've been talking about in this last, you know, time together, it really has changed our lives, hasn't it? It really has changed everybody. Everybody is, you know, watching videos online, watching, using the web for research. I think the biggest major thing that the World Wide Web has done is two things. One is it's given us access to a ton of information. If you want to know something, you can Google it. I mean, one of the things that made research easy for me the second time around, the first time around it was like all Morse files and, you know, paper copies of stuff. But the second time around, if I needed to check to see if a particular piece of technology had been invented by that time,
right,
I could Google it and learn it in, you know, 20 seconds. The other thing that's good about the World Wide Web is that the fact that we really are connected. We can connect with people all over the world, and we can learn about what they're doing. We can have relationships with them. In the various writer communities that I'm involved in, there's people from across the globe that get together, which is not something that we could really do easily before. You know, I think the bad and the ugly that you mentioned, of course, there is the darknet. There's a lot of, you know, criminal activity that happens underneath the covers of the World Wide Web, as we know about, and That's obviously the bad and the ugly part of it, but I think the good outweighs the bad.
So true. What do you think going forward for the next 10 years? What can we expect from the internet?
The internet is going to become native to us as mm-hmm. human beings. And by native, I mean embedded in us. I know that sounds, might sound a little scary, but let's think about this. We've got Google Glasses. We've got watches. It's going mm-hmm. to be there's going to be a point where the technology is going to be, you know, really literally we wear it. We it's part of us. It's not something that we go to. It's something that we are part of. And I think that's going to be the challenge is going to be making that a benefit to people rather than a detriment to people.
Very interesting. Do you think there will be additional breakthrough that no one have conceived just yet?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, we don't know what we know until we know it, right?
So
and,
true.
You know, it's funny you say that because the guy who invented the television, this is kind of a little bit of, for trivia people, this is a little bit of trivia here. The guy who invented the television, I do not remember his name, actually said at the time he invented the television that we should shut down all the research centers because everything that could be invented had been invented.
That's
that was
true.
Like in 1940-something.
right.
So being someone who's seen technology from the early 90s to now, I would never say never. There's a billion bright kids out there who are inventing new things every day, and I think it's going to continue to be a really exciting place.
Coming back to your book, what's interesting about it, it took you about 10 years to get it published and get it out there to people. Having said that, looking at if you had published it back then, there is no such thing as an e-book. Now you have that opportunity to do that.
One of the reasons that I didn't publish it then was my only option. When the publisher went out of business, I had an agent, and she said, don't worry about it. This is a good book. We'll find another publisher.
Yeah.
She came back to me about 3 weeks later and said, everybody's telling me the same thing. Nobody cares about this technology stuff. So she suggested I do. Really the only option, and this is something for people who are new writers today, the world is so open to you now that was not available. We have, you know, your radio, the Blog Talk Radio opportunity, which, you know, you would have to be part of the big commercial station network. Now you can have a show like yours. But freedom to publish, I think, is so exciting today because at that time, it was just what they call vanity publishing. You know, mm-hmm. you went to somebody and they printed your book and you had to buy 1,000 copies and it sat in your garage.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want to do that. And so I put it aside to see, you know, I didn't expect it was going to be put aside for as long as it was. But, you know, life happens and things change. But I really do think for new writers, it's very exciting that there's really no gatekeeper today. You can publish your book as soon as you want to, when you feel ready, and you can do it without a lot of gatekeepers or a lot of hurdles in the way.
Interesting. So true. What three things can you share with aspiring authors to help them in their journey?
I think the first thing, and I think the fact that my book is published 20 years after I first wrote it, never give up. If you believe in your story, if you believe in your characters, keep writing, keep improving. And I would say the second thing is to always be curious and always be willing to learn and make those changes. I wrote this book actually 5 times, the entire
mm-hmm.
book.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a lot of what I consider to be talented people read it and give me good feedback that made the book better.
Mm-hmm.
I think getting involved with a critique group or finding other writers or people, even if they're not writers, whose opinion that you respect, that can look at your work and give you an honest feedback, and that will always, always improve your work. And the third thing I would say is to, you know, believe in yourself, believe in what you're writing, and know that you have a story to tell.
Wonderful. You mentioned just now about getting affiliated with Writers Group, correct?
Yes.
How has that impacted you in a way to help you with your book?
Well, I can give you a couple of examples. The first one was I live in Sacramento, California, and I was involved in the 2011 timeframe with the Davis Writers Salon, which is a wonderful critique group that, honestly and truly, there's a chapter in this book that I presented to them three times. And the first two times, they ripped it apart, and the third time, they said, this is ready to go. And I can tell you it's one of the, from in my mind, it's one of the best chapters in the book. So having that critique experience, I think, is really huge. I also now work with another group of writers in the Sacramento area, which are new writers, and we're sort of, you know, on the journey together, supporting each other, mentoring each other. I think writers do spend a lot of time in their own heads, and you have to in order to write a good book, or you spend time in your character's heads. You also need that outside support and then outside encouragement to take the writer's journey.
Wonderful. You have also set up a company to help market someone else's book as well, haven't you?
Yeah, CFP Media Group, yes, is set up as an indie publishing house. And right now, Web of the Trail is the first book is published, but I'm talking to other writers about helping them get their books published. I really believe in writers producing work and putting it out there for readers to enjoy. And so if I can help facilitate that process in any way, shape, or form, either being a mentor, helping with critique, I want to be part of that process. So my goal for CFT Media Group is to make it really a very strong boutique independent publishing company where new writers in particular can come and hopefully get support and get their work out to the public and to readers.
Wonderful. How has writing Web of Betrayal impacted you personally?
I think that I have now become someone who only wants to write fiction. I still have to write a lot of nonfiction for my clients, for my consulting, for my business, but I really, really love taking the fiction route, and I want to continue to do that. Those characters are still with me. I actually wasn't planning to write a sequel, but a lot of people ask about, is there going to be a sequel? And I sort of was wondering, you know, and honestly, just like the first idea, the second idea just came to me. I just all of a sudden saw Peter 20 years later and said, oh, I know what you're doing. And I need to tell people about that. So that was fun.
Has some of your former colleagues read the book and kind of find themselves weaved into the stories?
Yes, a little bit. Although, again, I didn't want to do the retro ripoff. It's really easy. We've got some major characters in the Valley, and I didn't want to do just a straight ripoff of one of those major visionaries. I really wanted my characters to be unique, but definitely people have seen some of themselves, and they've also kind of gotten a little bit of a retro blast from the past. My colleagues said from, remembering what it was like, you know?
Interesting. How about your family? Has anyone given you any feedback with regards to the book?
Well, my family was very, very supportive and helpful in the entire process. My sister, who is truly a fashionista, was one of the people that I went to for the fashions and the decor of the book, and she was really helpful there. My brother-in-law is an ex-LAPD officer, so he is definitely the person I went to for weapons advice and some of the techniques that are used in the book that way. And my mom probably read every version I wrote.
That's wonderful. What is next for you?
Well, as I said, I'm working on the sequel. So the sequel is called Search, and it's about Peter's search for a purpose after another great loss in his life. And I've also got two new characters that I'm really excited about. One character is a reporter that works for Peter now. Peter's taken over a large a large news site, think of something like Huffington Post meets TechCrunch, and and he's running that, and he has a group of reporters working with him. And there's one reporter who is ex-military Afghan soldier, cop, and now investigative reporter who's turning out to be the star of that book. And I thought I was going to kill him off in the first chapter. And he's gotten so strong that I think he may end up with a book of his own someday.
Interesting. Very interesting. The number one question that writers have is the fact that how do they get into the zone in terms of their creative process, writing their work? Do you have a specific ritual that you go through to kind of get you in your zone to produce the work that you produce?
What I like to do, and I actually learned this from another writer friend of mine, is to never, when you're done writing for the day, don't complete your sentence. Leave your sentence or your paragraph or your scene open, because that is the easiest way to walk back into the environment and start writing again. If you finish your scene because you want to get something completely done, then you have to start something new when you walk in the door the next time. But if you leave your scene open, you kind of already are sort of in the progress, and you can jump into a lot faster. I've really found that to be helpful. The other thing I will do is I will go out and visualize. Just go to a different place. Sometimes it's my room. Sometimes it's another quiet place. Sometimes it's, you know, like in a park or something. I had one experience when I was working with Peter's character where I let my characters talk to me. I'm going to sound like a crazy lady, but I think the writers experience this too. You have these conversations with them because they are real. Yeah. They have to be real to you, or they're not going to be real to the reader. So we're having this conversation, and Peter keeps talking about the time when he was 4 years old. And at one point, I just stopped, and I just cleared my mind, and I said, okay, Peter, what happened to you when you were 4 years old? And these memories just poured forth. Out of his head into my head, and one of them became a very critical scene in the book that I hadn't anticipated. So those are some of the things that work for me.
Do you advise people to basically get into a meditative state, and in terms of channeling, in terms of trying to get the creative stuff going, and write several drafts daily to kind of get them going?
I think it's important to write. I think if you sit down and you go, I have writer's block, there's a blank screen or a blank piece of paper in front of me, I think it's important to write whatever's in your head, even if it's not related at all to your story. Meditation or something like that might be a good way to start. I like to visualize my scene or visualize my character's face and maybe what mood or emotion they're in at that point. I like to work from the psychological and the values perspective rather than the action perspective. Actions, obviously, if you're writing a thriller, action's critical. But I think actions are driven by choices. And if I don't know what my character's choices are, their moral choices, their value choices, their personal relationship choices, if I don't know that, the action feels superimposed on top of the character. In other words, the character's going through the motions. They're not really driving the action. And so I like to start with that meditation part, visualizing the character and visualizing their mood, and that often will create an opening for a scene. Now, there's a lot of things that I write, and I've heard other writers say this as well, that I never use, that I, you know, just write for writing. For example, in the new book, when Peter and this new character, his name is Lee, meet, the book takes place 4 years after they first met. But I need to know why they first met and how that first meeting went, because there's some conflict areas that have to be resolved with the two of them. And if I don't know how those things started, I can't really write how they're going to evolve. So that's something I do as well.
Interesting. What makes a good mystery thriller story?
I think you have to really have strong conflict, and you have to have very strong motive. I think motive really drives the mystery. Why is this person doing this? What's at stake for them? What's going to happen if they do or don't complete their quest? I think that's what has to drive the mystery thriller. And I also think you have to be aware that you have to make sure that there's something happening all the time. I got some great advice, and I do not remember which book this came from. It may have been Stephen King. I'm not sure. But the advice was this. Your characters should never be alone. You should never have characters in deep thought. You know, it depends on the scene, of course. But the idea is have something happening all the time so the reader's being carried forward on a real journey and not just sort of stuck somewhere, you know, in some of the thought process. And I think that that can be challenging.
Do you
but
have
I think
mentors?
It's very important. Yes, I do. I have. I belong to Sisters in Crime, which is a great organization for women who write mysteries and thrillers and other crime type books. And they're a super supportive group. And within that group, there are a couple of people that I really rely on to give me great advice.
Wonderful. We're coming close to the end of the hour. Since our show is about people, family, and living life, what would you like to share as a recipe for living with our listeners this morning?
First of all, Johnny, let me thank you for the opportunity to speak with you and speak with your audience. It's really a privilege to be here, and this is a great show, and just really enjoy the opportunity to speak with you. And in terms of recipe for life, the first thing I would say is treat each day as a new day. When you get up in the morning, make it a new day. I know we all have a tendency to bring that past day's frustrations or whatever with us. I try not to do that. I try to say, this is a new day. Let's start fresh. Let's look at it fresh. The other thing that I think is important as a recipe for life is to really look at ways that you can support people, to really walk out there with a servant's heart and look for ways to give rather than get. I really want this book to be a gift to people as opposed to me thinking, about the hard sales of it. And the third thing that's really important is just to believe in yourself and believe in what you in your own values and your own choices and to stay the course.
Wonderful. How has those recipes for living life helped you over the years?
I think that it's really kept me going through some very challenging times. I have been, both in working for companies, large companies, and I've also been for the last 10 years or so, I've been operating my own business, and also trying to work through the process of getting my first novel published. So I think there's been a lot of times when you do have a tendency to potentially get discouraged. As we all know, the Great Recession was not a gift to any of us.
Right.
Staying the course and believing that you really can accomplish the thing that you want to accomplish, I think is one of the things that has kept me going.
Wonderful. Claire, thank you for the wonderful recipes for living and for spending this hour with me on From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. To all our listeners, thank you for being with us. Please join me next Tuesday morning. My guest will be Amy Newmark, the publisher and editor-in-chief for Chicken Soup for the Soul. Amy and I will be discussing their latest release titled Chicken Soup for the Soul, Touched by an Angel. The book is a collection of 101 miraculous stories of faith, divine intervention, and answered prayers. For additional information about this show and future shows, please go to fmmktalkradio.com. Thank you for listening and have a blessed week. Claire, it has been a pleasure. Thank you again, and have a blessed day.
Thank you, Johnny.
Thank you. Bye-bye.